Now, even though I was a part of the planning process, I feel like I set myself up for failure. Lauren, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for preaching with power. Thank you for recognizing why you are here and why we are here in this space and all of the great cloud of witnesses that we stand for. Your story is significant, and your words are meaningful. He didn't want to go there. See, he had offers to teach at a couple places, maybe be a chaplain somewhere, and there was this really nice church, a big church, beautiful building, really nice office where you could see the city behind him. They paid well, too. He thought it was the right type of church for him. So he was on his way there, headed up for the interview and the trial sermon. But his dad asked him to stop by. Somebody wanted to meet him. A guy from another church with another offer. A smaller church in a smaller city. Only about 100 people went there. But his dad and the gentleman that visited promised that this church had potential. He still didn't want to go there. He told the visitor that maybe he would consider coming down for an interview, but he could make no commitments because the other church, First Baptist Church of Chattanooga, was in the bag. He was going to be going there, all but certain. But he would consider this little church in Montgomery. The story of that young preacher reminds me of Esther's story, in which Lauren has already hit on so importantly. But Esther, think about her, right? You know the story. Read the whole book, too, when you go by. It's only 10 chapters. You can do it in about 35 minutes. I did it earlier this week. I clocked it for you. Read the whole story. It's riveting. It's interesting. Esther is this orphan, so Mordecai, her uncle, takes her in. Their people, the Jews, have been exiled in Persia. Xerxes is the emperor during that time. It's about 467 BC. And the story is interesting because Esther and all of the characters in the book never actually mention God's name. They never say anything explicit about God other than this one point that sort of points to God that we just read. They don't say God's name by name. It's a book about an oppressed people, a minority group, trying to figure out how do we live in the kingdom? How do we survive? How do we assimilate in the kingdom? And one of the plans for their assimilation is that, well, the king's looking for a new wife. So Mordecai and Esther, hey, maybe you should audition, go and do this. Esther obliges, she goes and she does it, and what do you know? She gets into the court. She gets to be there with the king, but at the same time that that's happening, someone is envious of the Jewish people, Haman, and he and Mordecai don't get along, and so he concocts this big plan to where he's going to kill Mordecai and kill all of the Jews. I'll put an asterisk here. You know, it's interesting. Another thing about the book of Esther is that it struggled to make it into our biblical canon. Yeah. The church fathers fought about it because it didn't reference God specifically, and there was all this stuff, right, about the Jews. Our ancestors didn't care for this story, but the people that did won them over, and this story has particular power and relevance for Jewish people today. and for all of us religious minorities, ethnic, racial minorities today. As the story goes, Haman, as I said, tried to kill Mordecai and tried to kill all of the Jews. And so Mordecai does what he knows best. And so he says, go and tell Esther. Summon Esther and tell her that the king is getting ready to kill all of her people. And Esther, as the part that we read, she wavers because, well, it's illegal. It's against the law. It's illegal. I might die. It's illegal. I can't do this. I'm restrained. You know, it's against our policy to approach the king if you haven't been summoned. And Mordecai says, I know what the law says, but you got to do right anyways. And not just for us, Mordecai says, and Lauren highlighted this point, but also for yourself, because Mordecai says, for help will come for the Jews. But if you got authority, and you don't use your authority to help us, God will hold you accountable. Hear that however you want. If you have authority and you don't use your authority to help those who need it, you too will be held accountable. And it's not really a threat. I think it's a historical observation. You too will be held accountable. And so Esther has this kitchen cabinet experience where Mordecai speaks to her and she says, okay, go gather all of the Jews who are here and tell them to give up eating so they can help me find courage. And I will do the same thing. And I will break the law. I'll go before the king, and if I am to die, then I will die. Esther's story reminds me of that young preacher I was talking about earlier. If you know anything about me, you know who the preacher is already. It was Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. It was January 1954, and R.D. Nixon came to Daddy King's house and asked him to come over to Dexter. Daddy King didn't want the young Martin to go. Coretta didn't want to go. Martin barely wanted to go. But First Baptist of Chattanooga rejected him. Dexter Avenue made a pretty strong offer, and they reminded him that his mentor, Vernon Johns, had just stirred up Montgomery a little bit, and the place was ripe for a movement. So he went there in May of 1954. Two weeks after he started there, Chief Justice Earl Warren issued the Brown versus Board of Education decision. 3 months later, there began some discussion in Montgomery about how segregated the bus system was. 6 months later, as a part of the planning and organizing team, ML and some of the other leaders, Ralph Abernathy, Rosa Parks, decided that they would protest bus segregation. And they started the bus boycott on December 1st, 1955. But January 1956, about a month and a half into the bus boycott, ML, feeling pretty good about his decision to go to Montgomery, right, is driving home as a part of the bus cop, picking people up, and he's followed by a police car. They ask him to get out the car. They arrest him, they throw him in a paddy wagon, and as he tells the story, they drive, and he feels like they're driving away from downtown Montgomery. So he's nervous. Is this the night that I'm killed? He realizes that he didn't even know where the jail was, and they were actually driving towards the jail. He's released, gets out of jail, goes home, and at night while he's laying in bed, the phone rings. And it says, "Look, nigger, we're tired of what you're doing here in Montgomery. It's time for you to go, and you're going to regret it if you don't leave in a couple weeks." He says he's shook. He's pacing now across his living room floor. He goes to the kitchen. He can't sleep now. He makes a cup of coffee. And he sits at his kitchen table. And he wants to give up. And he prays this prayer to no particular deity in all of the biographies, it says. But he prays this prayer, "God, I don't think I can do this alone anymore. I've gotten to the point where I can't do it alone anymore." And at that moment, he says, it feels like all of his fears subsided. And at that kitchen table, he had this encounter with God that affirmed his belief about religion, that the essence of religion was much more about personal encounters with God. And it was that experience that gave him the power to not fear everything that happened over the next 12 years. I love this story. But what I don't love about this story and what I don't love about the biblical story is that sometimes we think that heroes such as Esther and ML King are the only ones that are supposed to live with courage and power. We resign the work to them. They say, well, of course, they've had these experiences. Esther's, "If I perish, I perish. Martin, well, I'm giving it all over to you, God." And we assume that they are the ones that are obliged to lead their people, that they are the ones that are obliged to liberate their people. We assume that they're the ones that have the courage to face the bombings and the stabbings and have the power to speak truth to power. But what if the lessons of these stories aren't so much about those heroes, but it's about you? What if, perhaps, in Mordecai's terms, what if, perhaps, you were called to this place, on this corner, in Northwest Washington, D.C.? Perhaps, what if you were called with your government job and your progressive leanings and your decent savings and your education complete and your immigration status intact? Perhaps, what if you were called to this place? At this time, where Sally and Maria are the co-pastors, where Erica and Elijah are associates, what if you were called to this place to be here with all your gifts and your talents and your longings and your desires and your speech and your writing and your work and your ethics and your values? What if you were called at this place with all that's happening in the world in the midst of these deportations, in the midst of a pro-white affirmative action lawsuit and travel bans and trans bans and presidents who encourage the police to use more force? What if you were called to this place at this time so that you could be church, so that you could speak and live with power, with courage, with the faith of Esther and Mordecai and ML and all of those folks? I don't know. But with all the stuff happening in the world, I wonder if our experiences, if our encounters today are our own kitchen encounters, where God wants us to find the courage to trust, like, we can actually do something about the evil that we see. And it's not left to other people. it might be left to us. Perhaps you were called to this place, this moment in history, in time, this location, not that far from where it's all going down, for a time such as this. I pray that you might discern that, and that we might have the courage to do that.